Hey guys, and welcome to the Alabama Freshwater Fishing Report, presented by Great Days Outdoors Magazine. The first podcast to bring you the local fishing report for Alabama's lakes and rivers, whether it's good, bad, or ugly. I'm your host, Nick Williams, and this week's show is brought to you by... Alrighty guys, welcome back to another week's episode of the Alabama Freshwater Fishing Report. Hope everybody's been enjoying this September. I know I have. I got out and shot a few teal, shot a few hogs with our small game season down here on our public lands. Been catching some fish on topwater. So fall is a great transition time of the year. We've had some good reports in the past couple of weeks. The problem, as anybody who's lived down here the whole life knows, is that it's hurricane season. And we got Hurricane Helene coming in. Looks like that's going to mess up a lot of the fishing this week. So with that in mind, since I don't reckon there's going to be a lot of people out there on the water this weekend, it looks like it's going to throw off some pretty strong storms throughout a lot of the state. And then some of our guides, you know, they're going to be kind of out of pocket, getting ready, kind of getting their boats off the water and everything. So we're going to kind of take a breather this week. But what we're going to do, we're going to recircle back to an episode that we did last year's, two episodes, actually, three different interviews with some of our Alabama Waterkeepers organization. So if you didn't catch that one last year, if you're a new listener, we like to support our waterkeepers. They do a lot of good work educating people about fish consumption advisories and the importance of clean water, you know, for the economy, just for, you know, the health of the citizens of Alabama, but then also to preserve environmental diversity and the fishery. You know, clean water makes for better fishing. So they do a lot of work for the anglers here in the state, and we like to have them on. They know our waterways really well. And we're going to talk this week, we're going to have Justin Overton with the Coosa Riverkeeper Organization. We're going to have Will Strickland with the Mobile Baykeepers Organization. And then we're going to have David Butler from the Cahaba. So that's not a complete list of all the water keepers that are here in the state. There's many, many more that work on the Black Warrior and the Tennessee. I've heard whispers of one starting up on the Tallapoosa. But this will give you kind of a broad sample throughout the state. And if you like what you hear, I would just encourage you, get involved in those organizations. They do a lot of real good work in the community. So I'm going to get off my soapbox and we're going to jump right into it. I hope you enjoy it. All right, guys, we're here today, and with our first guest, we have Justin Overton with the Coosa Riverkeepers. Justin, how you doing?
I'm awesome. Thank you so much for having me.
Awesome. Good deal. Now, I'm glad to have you on here. Have y'all, did y'all enjoy that little cool snap that came through last week?
I really did. I actually took a vacation last week and spent some time in an off-grid cabin on the Locust Fork. So it was really nice waking up to some cool weather, especially when you don't have AC. So it was a good time. But it's hot. I was on the water yesterday, and I was like, oh, that cool snap, it was flirting with me because it's back. The humidity and heat is back for real.
No, it didn't take long. We had a vacation too. We went up to Auburn and spent some time beating around up there. Went to like Chewakla State Park and some spots on the Tallapoosa River and Tuskegee Forest. And yeah, there for a day or two, if you got up early, you know, temps in the 70s in the morning, it was nice. And then by the time we were coming home, I was looking at the thermometer on the car and it was 101 degrees. So
it didn't last it's long. Been relentless. It really has been.
Well, tell me a little bit about yourself and tell our listeners just kind of your background. I know you're a local. Kind of how did you grow up? What kind of got you interested? What started you down the path to end up working with Coosa Riverkeeper?
Yeah, well, I mean, I was an outside kid, and I think that's really where it all began, is that I have always felt much more comfortable with dirt under my fingernails and a sunburn being in the woods or on the water. And so for me, the outdoors has always been a place of respite. And I live in one of the most beautiful places in the whole country, Alabama, right? The River State. And so I grew up in the bottom of a really crappy John boat on Logan Martin Lake on the Coosa River, and trying to tell my parents to stop fishing so I could go swimming. And so a lot of my childhood was really shaped around my parents fishing, me swimming. You know, I was like one of those kids that my mom would have to like throw a t-shirt in the water because I wouldn't get out to put sunscreen on, and like throw me a hat. So my love for water has been a profound part of my life. And I feel very grateful that I get to now, as a profession, protect the waterways that, you know, I grew up on. But in terms of the advocacy part, you know, it's a lot of people love, you know, hunting, fishing, swimming, you know, outdoor recreation. But not everybody is called to advocate for better regulations and policies. And so I was first sort of exposed to that about 8 or 9 years old. My dad is from Anniston, Alabama. And Anniston is the very first place that polychlorinated biphenyls, or PCBs, which is an industrial lubricant that was used in tons of consumer products as well as industrial purposes, was first commercially manufactured. And it's actually like you can see the facility from my grandmother's house. And so I grew up going to Anniston and, you know, wanting to be an outside kid. And, you know, there's this amazing pear tree in my grandmother's yard. And I was never, my dad would never let me play there in the dirt and like outside. And I remember arguing with him a lot about like, I want to go look at this creek. It was really a ditch. But when you're a kid, a ditch looks like a creek, right? So, right. And so I was exposed through arguing with my dad about that, like water quality and water clarity are not synonymous with each other. And he was like, it'll make you sick. And so I remember being a kid and being like, how can something I love, like the outdoors, impact my health? And so I kind of took that life experience and growing up fishing and eating fish from the Coosa with my family. I mean, I learned years later that my grandfather actually was impacted by that PCB and passed away from cancer. And so I was personally impacted and had a loss due to that. I never got, my dad lost his dad at a very early age. And so when I was in high school, you know, being a young kind of angsty counterculture chick, I was, you know, I got really into like, how can I make the world better? And that was the gateway drug for me into advocacy. And now I get to apply that childlike sense of wonder of loving the outdoors to inspire other people to protect the places that they love. And I just think that's like, I could not have dreamt a better job for me, you know, that I get to be on a boat. I get to talk to congressmen about why the Coosa matters. And I get to talk to fine folks like you that like just understand the importance for our economy as well as for our society, that like outdoor recreation is vital. It's vital, you know.
Absolutely. So kind of tell me in broad strokes, it sounds like you're familiar with it if you grew up on Logan Martin Lake and with the work you do. What's the 50,000 foot view of the Coosa River system for? I know a lot of our listeners are on the Coosa Valley, but some of them are going to be on other river systems, recreate elsewhere, and they're mm-hmm. either not familiar with it or all that they know is, you know, the reservoirs on it. They may mm-hmm. have gone and taken a trip, been in a bass tournament out there a little bit. What yeah. can you tell me about that river system as a whole?
Yeah, so for those of your listeners that are not familiar with Coosa, I'm going to just go ahead and going to explain the geographic constraints of the Coosa. So the Coosa in totality is 280 miles. Its headwaters are the Oostenaula and Etowah rivers, and they form in Rome, Georgia, to form the Coosa River. So Coosa Riverkeeper, we work in the middle and lower Coosa Basin in Alabama. So we work on 220 miles of that 280-mile system. So essentially, if you were to draw a map, it's essentially from Fort Payne, Alabama, to Wetumpka, which includes Neely Henry Lake, Logan Martin Lake, Lay Lake, Lake Mitchell, Lake Jordan, and then the tailwaters of the Coosa in Wetumpka, which is actually not only the most paddled stretch of any river in Alabama, but it is the only free-flowing stretch of the Coosa system because it has been impounded so many times. So the Coosa suffered the greatest mass extinction of critters in North American history when it was dammed. And so that's actually what spurred the formation of our nonprofit, Coosa Riverkeeper, is because there was not a group that can speak for the river. I say this all the time. My staff actually makes fun of me about it, but like a river has a head and a mouth, but it doesn't have a voice to speak for itself. And so that's what riverkeepers do, is that we're out there speaking for the river and the critters that rely on it, as well as the communities that rely on it. So we work in 5,000 square miles of Alabama on that 220 miles of river system. And that includes not just the reservoirs, but all the skinny water. That's what we call it, at least skinny water. So, you know, Chocolaca Creek, Big Wills Creek, Big Canoe Creek. And despite that mass extinction, there's still a huge amount of fish, snail, and mussel diversity in this river system. So I think it's really important that although a lot of folks probably hit the lakes and they are there for like Alabama Bass Trail, or they are there for the Bassmaster Elite, there's so much richness in the woods as well as in those feeder creeks that are totally worth exploring. So like I just encourage anybody who's looking for a place to go to like open up Onyx, like get on a mapping software and poke around, because some of the most breathtaking places that I've been able to experience in my job have been completely random. I'm following up with a citizen calling about a pollution complaint, and I just get the opportunity to stumble on like this beautiful rock outcrop on this creek. You know what I mean? So we as an organization are trying to meet the needs of a lot of different river users, right? So like a bass angler who's like there for a tournament is going to have a completely different understanding and value to the work that we provide for public notification and water quality data than maybe a grandmother whose grandkids are coming for the weekend to go swimming. So we're constantly trying to be sure that we are meeting the needs of not just the river, but the people that use the river, to provide them data to make informed decisions so that they aren't eating fish that cause cancer, or so that they aren't swimming in sewage, but also to empower them to make better decisions to protect their health.
I like what you said earlier. Two things I like that you said. One, Lake Jordan. I've heard of Lake Jordan, and I've heard of Lake Jordan, and my family used to have a place up on Jordan.
Yeah, it's dirt. It's like when you say Wetumpka versus Wetumpka, like I have to have street cred, you know, it's dirt.
Yeah. The version of it down here, you can always tell if you're getting a telemarketer or somebody calls and says, are you Nick Williams from Mobile, Alabama? Click.
Yeah.
And I like what you said too, you know, going back to your story. With PCPs in the creek that ran behind your grandmother's house, the idea of clarity does not equal cleanliness, mm-hmm. because that's something down here. Our waters are very muddy, you know, arguably muddier than they should be, muddier than they were 200 or 300 years ago, but you kind of get used to it. And as I've traveled the state, yeah, it's real easy. You get up in the northern parts of the state on the Coosa, the Tallapoosa, and the Black Warrior Rivers, and it's clear. You know, I was fishing the other day in a place where you could see bass down in 10 feet of water.
Wow.
And you look at it and you think, wow, it's, you know, clean, clear water, and you can't see all of the contaminants. You can see some of them sometimes, you know. I think everybody's been out on the water and seen, you know, oil on the surface from a two-stroke, or maybe you see discharge pipes, or it's really easy if you have a construction site and they've got a problem with their silt fence and their, you know, sediment control program. You can see that out on the water. But a lot of it, like you said, PCB is, you can't see, you can't tell looking at it, right, if a fish is good to eat.
Right.
Like sometimes you'll see them in the warmer months, and you can see a sore on a fish, and people will post it up on the local groups, and they'll go, hey, yeah, is this safe to eat? But then there's a lot of fish, if you're looking at a live well and there's 20 fish in them, you can't tell if they have mercury in them or not. So a lot of the problems, I guess, that you guys face aren't readily visible. And I know you mentioned kind of a list right there, talking about PCBs, talking about fish consumption advisories and stuff like that. What do y'all do kind of on a day-to-day base as far as your boots on the ground efforts to combat those issues?
So, well, I'm going to go back just a hair. So I am really, really interested in public notification. I think that's something that makes Coosa Riverkeeper a little bit different than some of our other partner groups, is that our state motto is we dare to defend our rights. But what does that mean when you don't have a right to know information? You don't have a right to know where the fish are unsafe to eat. You don't have a right to know where sewage is entering your waterways, or toxins are, you know, entering the waterways through public notification. So I just want to say, blanket statement is that, like, I don't want to discourage anybody from doing anything. I want to empower them with the appropriate information to make an informed decision about when and where they decide to enjoy a waterway. So a lot of what we do is really grounded in that. It's like, how can we collect data? How can we fill in these gaps in public understanding and in water quality data and present it to the people where it's like red, green, yellow, like our swim guide program, where we're monitoring the amount of E. coli, because people are busy. They just want to get on the river. Because they, if they're like me, they're like, hell, it's 5 o'clock. I'm ready to go. Like, let's get out there. And so we really focus on the data collection and then trying to synthesize that into a way that a person of any background, any literacy rate, any language barriers, any technological barriers, because 25% of the people in the Coosa River Basin don't have ready access to broadband internet. So like, how can we make sure that we're not like leaving out a subset of anglers or of like river enthusiasts just because they don't have the internet? So our work is grounded in that. But in terms of the day-to-day, like I'll just give you this week, because there is no normal here. Yesterday I was on lay and half of my team was in the truck getting samples from smaller creeks that we were not going to be able to get the boat up, and the other half of us were on our patrol boat called the Olive Two. For any boat nerds out there, we've got a Sea Arc Bay Runner 210 with a 150 Mercury outboard. It's sweet. I love that boat. And her name is the Olive Two because Popeye the Sailor Man was actually inspired by the Coosa River. The creator of
Really?
it was from Gadsden. And our very first patrol boat was a really shitty, wait, can I say shitty? Sorry, Johnny. Sorry, Johnny, if I can't. Okay, so I'll say it again. Our first patrol boat was a really crappy Alumacraft green John boat that was Olive. And so when we got the funding to get an upgraded patrol boat, I was like, obviously, we've got to get a green boat and name it the Olive too. So our team yesterday was a divide and conquer situation to do PFAS, which is an emerging contaminant that the Coosa has a huge issue with due to being downstream from a lot of heavy carpet manufacturing. So we did PFAS testing yesterday. This is my only day in the office today. So today I am like managing my staff. And then tomorrow I'll be on Logan Martin doing a PFAS sampling again by truck, by boat. Thursday I'll be on Mitchell, Jordan, and Tailwaters doing bacteriological water quality monitoring on all of those reservoirs for our swim guide program, where we tell people where it's safe to swim or not each week. And then Friday I'll be on Mitch, no, I'll be on Neely Henry doing PFAS samples again. So this is summer is a very heavy field work season for us just because it is river season. But there is no normal. I love the field work. I am the happiest when I'm doing the field work, even if that means I have awkward tan lines and bruises and scrapes and too many tick bites to count. But that's definitely where I think the heart is. We do a lot of community engagement. So when there is an issue and we want to educate the community, we try to go into communities and foster relationships with them to empower them. There is an aspect to our work where we do Clean Water Act compliance and enforcement. So we are a litigious organization. That is a tool. That doesn't necessarily mean it's always the most appropriate tool. Sometimes it's great to bring somebody to the table and say, "Hi, I've noticed you've had a lot of issues with your facility. How can we help?" Sometimes you've got bad actors and they need to be held accountable. And so our state regulatory agency, the Alabama Department of Environmental Management, has consistently demonstrated that they're more interested in issuing the permits than they are protecting the waterways in which the permits or the permit holders are discharging into. So, I think it's also important to note that, when it comes to clean water and healthy people and communities, we should not have to choose between a healthy economy and a healthy physical environment. Neely Henry Lake brings in over $10 million in new revenue every single year just from bass tournaments alone. So why would we want to pollute a reservoir, any waterway, when it has the economic potential to bring people here, to spend money here, to move here and invest here? So anyway, I'll get off my soapbox about that, but like I feel very strongly that the Clean Water Act is one of the most fantastic tools that we have. And anglers in particular have played a huge role in our organization with finding bad actors and holding them accountable, whether it be in a courtroom or be in the court of public opinion.
Justin, you mentioned earlier that the work that you do different work for different people, different, users of the Coosa River system have different needs, different things that matter to them, right? Like a set of grandparents may want to know, well, hey, if the kids are coming this weekend, can they jump off the dock and go swimming? Another group may want to know, can we eat the fish? We talk with a lot of fishermen on this podcast. It is a fishing podcast, and I know that's something that I only recently, it's been within the past year, I had a conversation with Will Strickland on a duck hunt, and I was talking about eating fish on a trot line on a place on the Mobile Tensaw Delta, and he was kind of quiet for a second, and he was like, you ever read the fish consumption advisories? And just the way he said it, I was like,
Yeah.
I had to go look, and I looked, and that place did not have a consumption advisory for that species, but you go 5 miles over and there's just
Right.
like blackball, like do not eat any of the species in this
Yeah.
drainage. What can you kind of tell me about the fish consumption advisories? Where do people find out more about that? Where can people keep track of that? And then what can you tell me just briefly about why do we have fish consumption advisories in Alabama?
I'll do this as quickly as possible because I told you earlier I could talk about this for hours. So fish consumption advisories are issued by the Alabama Department of Public Health on an annual basis for specific sections of our state. So it is an advisory for a specific species of fish for a specific contaminant on a specific body of water. Generally speaking, most of the fish consumption advisories are for methylmercury, and methylmercury is atmospherically deposited into our waterways and taken up by fish through the food chain, due largely to coal fire power plants across the world, right? So the Coosa has two coal fire power plants on our system, and I certainly think that that probably contributes to some of the methylmercury advisories, although it doesn't really matter because the advisories are the advisories. So methylmercury is important to note because there's nothing you can do to reduce your exposure other than follow the advisories. Versus like PCBs, they're fat soluble. So how you prepare your fish and you fillet your fish can help reduce exposure. So especially for those of y'all that have ladies of childbearing age or any vulnerable people in your family, following the mercury advisories are really, really important. So if people are interested on the Coosa system to learn more about fish consumption advisories, they can visit our website, which is coosariver.org. And there is tons of information on our website about the advisories broken down by each reservoir. There is a statewide fish consumption advisory map available at waterkeepersalabama.org, which is interactive that you can click on no matter where you are and see the advisories. Coosa Riverkeeper and our partners update that on an annual basis. But, you know, that's really why when I was talking about public notification, we worked on the Safe and Healthy Outdoor Recreation Act, the SHORE Act, this past legislative session. And that's really what we're trying to do is get this fish consumption advisory program codified in law. Because right now it's vulnerable. They could stop doing this fish consumption advisory testing and work at any point. So the real heart of it is to ensure that there is some continuity in that and that we can make changes to encourage more contaminant testing in the program, more frequent testing, have a budget for the program, and also have the opportunity for the public to weigh in. But most importantly, it's about the science. So Coosa Riverkeeper has had a angler survey program for the past 7 or 8 years. So we actually have a team of people that go out during different seasons, during different times of the day, on the boat and on docks, to actually talk to anglers about their understanding of the advisories. Because knowing about the advisories and understanding what they mean is oftentimes very different. So we have several reports, a deep analysis of our data that we've collected that is specific to the Coosa system. I really hope that others will start asking their anglers, because you cannot assume what people know. And also, it's been really helpful for us to get a better understanding of the ways that we can get this information to the people who need it most. And that has been signs. So Coosa has, as an organization, has posted over 50 signs throughout the Coosa Basin, specifically on creeks like Chocolaca Creek, which did get all of that PCB contamination that I talked about earlier. But we're working with other riverkeepers throughout the state and working with the partners through the Army Corps of Engineers to ensure that all of the public access points owned by the Corps and DCNR that have active advisories have a sign. But the thing is the SHORE Act would ensure that it's at all of the ramps, including like the fishing piers below the dams, like the tail races of these places where we know that people are going to fish and are oftentimes fishing for sustenance in those areas. So the signs, I think, are critically important to getting people. Again, it's not illegal to eat these fish, but we're just trying to make sure that people are empowered with this information so that they can make informed decisions. Because I know some of these folks, this is a matter of like, I want a local source of protein because it's economically feasible for my family. Or it's just an intergenerational tradition. Like, I grew up eating a mess of crappie, you know, like crappie is delicious. But for instance, on a lot of our reservoirs, they don't actually test crappie at all. They may test them, you know, in the Tennessee and maybe the upper parts of the Coosa, but they're not testing crappie consistently. And I think that's another opportunity for improvement is like, people are not really eating a lot of striped bass, according to our data, but they're consistently testing striped bass. It'd be really cool if they were testing crappie, because we know people are consistently eating crappie. So it's been a long journey, and there's tons of ways that people can get involved. But visiting coosariver.org can get you those Coosa specifics about the advisories, as well as lots of additional information about how to reduce your exposure. And we've got like recipes and stuff to hopefully encourage people to follow the advisories while also reducing their exposure when and where they can.
It's definitely the fish consumption advisory is an interesting rabbit hole to dive into. Mm-hmm. I know we've got limited time, but that's a question that I have had with other people is, if you have a waterway and you're looking and it has a do not eat advisory for black bass, you know, because mercury accumulates in tissue and a piscivore, you know, the fish that eats other fish accumulates that mercury rapidly. And then there's not a crappie advisory. And it's like, well, crappie eat, you know, the same forage that bass do on a large level. You know, they're also eating shad, you know.
Right.
So that's, and I've asked, you know, is that something that's being tested? Like, and it's like, well, so that is interesting. And I definitely support what you guys are doing, putting the signs out. You're talking about broadband internet access. I was driving through a county the other day and I pulled some statistics on it. And yeah, per the census information, you've only got about 50% of the population with a broadband internet connection. So flip a coin if they have a way to check the advisories now, which is kind of buried on the Alabama Department of Public Health.
Yeah, kind of buried. That's generous.
It is buried. And then the way a lot of the reporting is hard even for me to keep track of. Like we stayed up at Lake Martin on the Tallapoosa River system, and a buddy of mine were both aware of the consumption advisories. We went fishing there and we checked it, and we're just kind of skimming. It's like, well, I don't see Lake Martin listed anywhere. Is there being an advisory? When you dig into it, one of the tributary creeks that feeds right by where we were staying, we were like, oh, we can catch fish and it's not a big deal. Whatever we catch, we can fry. And then you read between the lines, you're like, well, wait, no, right there, half mile from where we're staying, there's an advisory. So yeah, I support what you guys are doing. I think that's definitely something as an angler that people should be aware of. If people want to kind of get involved with what you're doing, if they want to learn more or help you guys out, what's a good way for them to do that?
Well, give us a follow if you're on social media, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. Tag us in your personal best pic. I love seeing the grip and grins from people. I know for us, we have a couple of things coming up. We actually are hosting a fly fishing tournament in Wetumpka, the 6th through the 8th. It's called the Southern One Fly. So if you go to southernonefly.com, you can get all the details about the rules and the tournament map. It's going to be a good time. We'll be staying at what used to be known as Coosa Outdoor Center, but we're going to have bands and just have a great weekend of fishing and fellowship, and really just trying to get folks on the skinny water of the lower Coosa Basin. So it's all of the feeder creeks, Mitchell. So that includes places like Hatchet Creek. So if y'all have never been on Hatchet Creek, it's a gem. Go wade and enjoy it. And then also the feeder creeks to Jordan, and then the tailwaters there in Wetumpka. So that's coming up. There's also a coal ash hearing. There's a virtual hearing on the 27th, but there's going to be an in-person hearing through the EPA on the 20th. So if folks are interested in learning more about that, you can visit any of the Riverkeepers websites or Facebook, social media to learn more about that. We need folks to get out there and get loud and talk to the EPA about why coal ash needs to be moved off of our waterways to an upland lined landfill. They're a ticking time bomb and they're leaking all kinds of heavy metals and pollutants into our waterways, our waterways. So I think it's super important that, you know, if you find yourself at night dreaming about being on your boat and like I do, then that probably means you need to come to Montgomery on the 20th. And I can send you some information about that to get people signed up. But we need a lot of people there.
Absolutely. Well, Justin, I definitely appreciate the time that you've donated to us today. Appreciate all of the hard work that you do. Guys, y'all be sure to check out the Coosa Riverkeepers website or your local Riverkeepers website. There's Riverkeepers all over the state of Alabama that do similar work to what Justin and her crew were doing there. Justin, hopefully we can have you back on the podcast at a later date. I know we do a freshwater fishing report. I think it's good to periodically check in, not just on how the fishing is, but how's the water doing. So
yeah, well, thank you so much for what you're doing. And thank you to those of you that have taken the time to listen. I hope I see you on the river soon.
Absolutely. I will be up that way. I'm trying to catch a fish on a fly in all 67 counties. So
I will
be on the Coosa River system.
Yeah, let me know.
Absolutely. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Alrighty, guys, that was Jordan Overton with the Coosa Riverkeeper. If y'all are local to that waterway, y'all be sure to go over there and check out the Coosa Riverkeeper's website. I think they do a really awesome job, like Jordan said, posting information, particularly on fish consumption advisories. I really think they've set the example in Alabama for making that information easily accessible to everybody. They've really led that charge. So if you fish and you like to eat fish, that's something you should keep track of, and they've made it easy for you. So go check them out. And we're going to go ahead and take a quick break and hear from some of this week's sponsors. This week's episode of the Alabama Freshwater Fishing Report has been brought to you by... Did you know every 40 seconds someone has a heart attack or stroke? In that moment, every second counts and every critical decision matters. Air Medcare Network's air ambulance providers can bring life-saving care directly to those in need at a moment's notice. With 320 locations across 38 states, Air Medcare is the largest air ambulance network. Rest assured, they've got you and your entire household covered. Membership is just $99 a year, or just $79 for seniors. Visit gdo.com/airmedcare to enroll. Bucks Island is a family-owned and operated business since 1948. They have new pontoon boats, bass boats, bow riders, and aluminum boats for sale. They love trade-ins for boats and motors. They can rig your boat or ship your new motor anywhere in the United States. They provide boat service on all kinds of boats, even if they weren't purchased from Bucks. They have factory-trained and certified technicians. Visit them at 4500 Highway 77, Southside, Alabama, 35907 zip code, or give them a call at 256-442-2588. Alrighty, guys, we're back. This time we're talking with the executive director of Mobile Bay Keepers, Will Strickland. Will, how you doing today, sir?
Doing all right. I'm a little sleepy after our morning adventures, but it's been a great day.
It was definitely a great day outdoors this morning. We had a good old time. With folks listening in, me and Will, we're kind of hunting buddies. We snuck away. We played a little bit of hooky this Tuesday morning and shot some ducks this morning. It was a good time. Y'all may remember we had last summer we had several of the waterkeeper organizations here on the show. Will heads up my local waterkeeper organization, Mobile Bay Keepers. They're here to help us kind of take care of the waterways that we fish and that some of our contributors like Dip McMillan fish. Will sits here and he kind of leads the charge, keeping everything clean, holding people accountable when he needs to, helping to educate people, does a whole lot for the community. Last time we talked, I think I talked with, not you, it was Cade Kistler, and he actually, he did the recording. He was actually out on y'all's patrol boat. So he was actually working for a living, not playing hooky shooting ducks. He was hard at work, but, tell me what y'all been doing since then.
Yeah, that's a great intro to what we do. And I just want to frame it a little bit more before I talk about what we've been doing. You know, Baykeeper, we try to define success in the long term as that no one should have to question if the fish are safe to eat or the water safe to swim in. And when our oysters and seagrasses recover and our community takes responsibility for these things. And so as we look at the issues that we face, we will try to view it through that lens. How does it affect whether the fish are safe to eat, water safe to swim, oysters, seagrass, and then everybody's saying, hey, these are things that are important. And so since you talked to Cade, we had a big victory over on Rabbit Creek down here on the Dog River watershed, which for those of you that don't know is a kind of a tidal river. And Rabbit Creek is a tidal creek. It's crystal clear and it's got great wetlands along the side of it, and there is still an industrial park that they're going to build there in that watershed, but because our members raised their voices, we were able to secure over 100 acres of pristine wetlands that will be placed in the conservation easement, and it'll protect that stream side super important filtering water body there, and so the development will go on, but that Rabbit Creek will continue pretty much as we know it. It won't be muddied up, and it's to be a beautiful place to visit. The saga of the coal ash continues, and we are awaiting some more news from the EPA, which is the Federal Environmental Protection Agency. But they've said that they're going to take action at the coal ash pond up at Plant Berry, which sits along the side of the Mobile River and is leaking arsenic into the Mobile River. And I don't know about y'all, but arsenic sounds like something I don't really want in my waterways or my fish. So the EPA is going to take some action there, they've said, and they also said that if our state doesn't stop issuing permits for things like this, that they're going to deny their permitting privileges. So we await that good news when that starts to move next. And then we've also got an oyster gardening game. So we've grown about 30,000 oysters over the last year, and we recently have harvested or are harvesting them, and then we're placing them on a restoration reef. So we're growing these oysters to maturity and then putting them out on reefs so that we can have those oyster reefs that that hold fish and other sea life, but also filter water, provide all kind of benefits for our ecosystem. So we've been up to a lot. Those are three of the things I figure folks would be most interested in now.
Yeah, for sure. I think that's something that I know I can't get enough of pretty little creeks and clean water and good old Mobile Bay oysters. I'm a big fan of all that. Most of our listeners are. That's all good news. Good to hear good news from you guys. Glad to hear y'all been busy making a positive change. I'll let you go ahead too. I like this podcast because I get to mix a little business and pleasure. I get to talk about the fishing reports with people. This is not a fishing report, but we do sneak in a little duck hunting in here. Most guys here, they do a little bit of duck hunting on the side. So I'll get you real quick. Give us the Mobile Tensaw duck hunting report. Give us the report as we close out the old 2023-2024 season.
Yeah, well, you know, the best thing to report is I had a great guide this morning. And anything that I'm going to report to everybody will be something that he told me probably. But, yeah, Nick and I got up early and went out there. And there's a little bit less water than last time we were out there for sure. And I think down from even recently. But, you know, we snuck up in a little hole and tried to get some wood ducks to come in on us. They didn't want to decoy up, so we had to take the passing shots, which, you know, got lucky a couple times. But the big news, and I'm going to have to snitch on my dog. She's right here next to me in the office. But Lily, she's a year old Boykin Spaniel. And, man, I've worked my tail off training her to be the perfect retriever. And so she was excited to be out in the woods today. It was her first hunt where she got any action. And, Nick, you saw it. She ran up to those ducks and sniffed them and said, I don't believe I want any part of that. So we got some work to do on the retrieving front. Young dog, but, man, she's sitting here asleep now because she's worn out.
That she is. Well, yeah, I measured it when we got done walking. It was about 2.5 miles in and 2.5 miles back. So we definitely it was not my prettiest hunt. Birds are kind of pressured down here. People have been shooting them up all year, and we got on some birds, but I definitely, that was not a good morning for decoying birds. And I was happy once you started shooting and started hitting some of them. It was kind of checking us out a little bit, buzzing that little hole. So you made some good shots. It was good to watch some good shooting, good to get out there, enjoy a cup of coffee, have some good conversation, and watch somebody who could actually shoot birds, because I cannot. But I gotta say, like, the ideal combination would be next time we'll let you shoot them and we'll let Amos go get them.
There you go. Amos is a regular contributor to the podcast, huh?
We'll let both of them hunt and he can show Lily how it's done.
He'll show her what to do.
He's an old expert. He knows exactly what to do once ducks hit the water, and he'd be happy. He lives to show people what you do once ducks hit the water. So no, it was a good time. And yeah, the water was definitely, you know, like I was telling you, walking over the bridge, you know, it fluctuates so much down here on the bay. It's such a dynamic environment. You know, we couldn't navigate under that bridge that we walked over this time last year. You know, it's been almost a year to the day since we went. And we sat there and we floated Globe Creek, did a little bit of jump shooting. And it actually, this segues, I think, well into our next talking point. So we were you know, talking about flooded creeks and jump shooting ducks and other things you could do on creeks. And I think the conversation of limb lines come up, and we were talking about running limb lines and trot lines. And you just kind of asked me as we were floating down the creek, and you were like, you ever look at the fish consumption advisories for the area? Because I just got done talking about, you know, filling up, you know, totes full of catfish up there. And you're like, you ever look at the fish consumption advisories? And I was like, well, no, I don't guess I have, really. And you were just like, oh, okay, well, that's, you know, that information is out there. And I was like, well, dang it. I said, now I got to go. So I got home and I started looking it up, and, you know, was I'd say not surprised. It made sense, but I was a little, just be frank, disappointed. Like, we have some fish consumption advisories right here where I fish, and then it was definitely something that kind of changed the way that I consume fish here. And I was glad to know, because it was right before my wife ended up pregnant with my daughter. So I really felt like I got lucky, just randomly out there hunting with somebody who brought it up and made me look at it and decide, man, maybe we need to slow our roll with these fish fries, while my wife is sitting here pregnant with my daughter, since we've got a mercury consumption advisory. So I think that's something that is very relevant to our audience. So tell me more about that. What can you tell me about the fish consumption advisories for the area?
Yeah, well, our state tests all over. They catch fish, and it's a combination of different agencies together. So you have Department of Conservation and Natural Resources. They're collecting the fish. You got the Department of Public Health, which are testing the fish, and then you have the Department of Environmental Management, which has a role in the decision of issuing advisories. And then letting the public know about where there's advisories. And so it's not uncommon for me to ask people, hey, have you ever looked at the advisories in your area? And to be honest with you, I didn't know about fish consumption advisories. When I was a kid, I grew up in Tuscaloosa. We'd fish the Black Warrior, but I do remember my grandfather, we wouldn't eat our catch on the Black Warrior often. When he grew up, that river was particularly polluted, at least in his mind. And so he says probably not a very good idea for us to eat whatever's in these fish. And I just thought that's how it was done. And I figure that's a lot of folks, most folks figure that's how it's done, is you make your best judgment call. What's being put in the water nearby? We go off of sight and smell. Does it look nasty? But actually, our state is doing this testing and they're reporting back to us. And so, I can speak for the Mobile area. Almost every water body down here in coastal Alabama has some sort of advisory on it. Now, they vary. You've got water bodies like the Mobile River that have an advisory that says, do not eat any fish from the Mobile River. That's a mercury advisory there. And so, I've asked folks that a lot. That's, a little party trick. I say, you ever heard the advisory on the Mobile River says, don't eat any fish from the Mobile River? People are shocked. Then you have other areas like we'll take Mifflin Lake, which is not far from where we were this morning. And there's an advisory there for largemouth bass that says limit yourself to 2 meals a month. Again, the contamination there is mercury. And so, there's these different levels. Some say just the fish are safe to eat, but in general, especially here in coastal Alabama where the whole state drains to it, there's some sort of advisory just cautioning you to limit the amount you eat or maybe don't eat any at all. One thing I want to say about that, from my perspective, like I asked you when we were hunting that day, I don't like to say, hey, you shouldn't be eating that fish, because I think everybody's got to make their own choice, right? But if our state's doing the testing, we ought to know about it. And I think that's the next part of it, that we're trying to do something about that, where more folks will know if their catch is safe to eat or not.
Yeah, that was definitely, you did not jump on me, say, oh, I wouldn't eat those fish. You don't need to eat those fish. You kind of encouraged me to do my own homework, and I did the homework. And I got to say, I like to think I'm a fairly literate, internet savvy person. But it was finding the information was more than just a quick Google search. It kind of took a little bit to find that report. And then once you had the report, you had to kind of it was one of those documents where you had to read the section on how to read the report, how to find your area. And it was frustrating. It wasn't something you could just, pull up a tab on your phone and 30 seconds later be like, okay, got it, don't eat catfish. I mean, it took some digging. And then I had to go do that. I've had to do that several times fishing throughout the state, like fishing up on a
Right.
Lake Martin, and we actually, me and a buddy went up there, and he was like, well, the good thing is I checked and Lake Martin doesn't have any fish consumption advisories. And I was like, really? He said, yeah. He said it's clean. I'm like, I don't know. It seemed weird to me. So I started digging, and the way that they had it laid out, if I hadn't known, There was an advisory there for El Cachi Creek, and that's where we were staying that weekend. Where we were fishing was where El Cachi dumps into Lake Martin. So I think it's great that we do the testing, but there's kind of something to me that's to be desired about how that's reported and how that's made available to the public. And we've talked some in the past with Justin up there at the Coosa River Keepers. Y'all have been kind of working towards for a couple of years trying to get that information made available. Am I right?
Absolutely. Well, if you want this information, you have two options. You can do what you did, and here I'll describe it to the listeners. All you have to do, you visit the Alabama Department of Public Health homepage. You click Who We Are, and you click View All under the About Us tab. You can either scroll down or you can click on the T's. It takes you down to the T's on the menu. But toxicology, scroll down some more. You click on Fish Consumption Advisories. Under the resources section there, you click on 2023 Fish Consumption Advisory Guidelines. That'll take you to 38-page PDF with all the advisories listed. You just got to find your water body and figure out in their table what's going on. So you can do that. Or you got a couple more options, and this is from the Water Keepers Alabama. You can visit the alshoreact.com. So that's alshoreact.com. And we have a map right there, and you can scroll right into your water body and click on the fish. It's color-coded, and it'll tell you right there. I just pulled up El Cachi Creek in Tallapoosa County, and the advisor says, do not eat any fish from that water body. Contamination is mercury. If you're out in on the water, though, and you want to make a call to figure it out, maybe you don't have good internet, but you can make a call. You call 844-219-7475 and somebody will pick up and they'll tell you what's going on, where you are. And if you don't speak English and you need it in Spanish, there's a Spanish option on that hotline as well.
Yeah, that's definitely the hotline would be easier. Especially I do a lot of traveling and trying to sort through that document. You're not kidding when you say it's 38 pages and it's just for my area too. The thing is, like it's not like there's just a general advisory for the Mobile Tensaw Delta where I fish. I mean, I think there's eight or nine different advisories for different places, right? It varies. Like you mentioned, there's one advisory for Mifflin and a whole another advisory if you go 5 miles over and you're on the Mobile River.
That's right.
So you'll have multiple, most anglers will have multiple advisories, even if they're just fishing one body of water. You could be fishing one lake and you could have different levels of contamination in different parts of the lake or different parts of the river system. And I'm sure you can tell me more about how that happens. But you mentioned the Shore Act. Back up. I'm a little familiar with it. I've kind of kept my finger on the Shore Act, but for our listeners, can you give us just kind of a broad level view of what that is?
Absolutely. So the Shore Act is a piece of legislation that we worked on last year. We didn't quite get it passed. It's not quite law, so we're giving it a go this year. And essentially, what it's going to do is make it a law that we make it easier for anglers to know if their catch is safe to eat. And so I described, I hope people enjoyed my comedy routine with the describing how you pull up a 38-page PDF. But what's even easier than our hotline is this law would require signs at every boat ramp, public boat ramp in the state, that have a picture of the fish and the listed advisory next to it. So there's no guesswork. You're launching your boat, and you can look on there and see a largemouth bass and how often you should eat it or if you should eat it at all. That's the main part of it. It'll also give you access to this information on your fishing license, and it will create a legislative task force. So there'll be people in charge of overseeing the program and making improvements along the way. So that's the bill we're pushing this year, and want to go ahead and thank Representative Lipscomb for sponsoring this bill in the House, and then Senator Sessions for sponsoring it in the Senate. And I think we have a real good shot of getting this passed this year, and you should be seeing these signs real soon.
Yeah, the signs would definitely be an improvement. That was as somebody who travels and fishes, that would make life much easier. And it seems like a simple improvement, right? Like you said, we do the testing, And we're you
That's
know
right.
kind of poking a little bit of fun at the system right here, because it is. I would encourage anybody listening in, take a second and find your local fish consumption advisory. And you may not need an undergraduate degree to do it, but you probably need a 2-year certificate to figure out how to navigate the website. There's definitely a learning curve to it, and even now that I check it fairly regular, I kind of have to refresh my memory each time. So it would be nice to simplify that process. I think that's great news. Again, it's not telling people what to do, right? Like I don't like to be told what to do. Most of the people I fish with, not exactly the crowd that likes to be told what to do, but I like to be able to make up my mind. If I go to an area and see that there's a fish consumption advisory, I'll still fish there, but it probably not keeping fish, probably not gonna clean fish if I can't eat but one, 2 meals a month. And something too for listeners listening in, they do have in that 38-page PDF, they talk about what a serving size is. And I'm telling on myself here, but whatever it is, 6 ounces or whatever, I eat a lot more than that in one serving. So me, if I eat 1 meal of fish, even if it says you can have two, about halfway through my first round, first po' boy that I make, I've exceeded my monthly limit for some of the areas that I fish. So, and I know something that comes up. I've talked with a few anglers about this, and I've talked with some guys who aren't really concerned, because they're like, well, most of the fish consumption advisories are for black bass, and I don't eat bass. And I'm not, I eat fish, I eat crappie, I eat catfish, I don't eat a lot of bass. And your experience talking with people, is that something where, folks are right and it's like, well, nobody eats fish, or people actually eating fish in your experience?
Yeah, so in my experience, people are eating fish, and by the way, I'm eating fish, and it's important that I know this advisor information, as I love it. Most of my diet comes from things that I've caught or killed, or somebody else that I know has caught or killed, and so being able to know what's going into that is important to me and my family, so I can make informed decisions. However, we have done a survey to. And of there's about 450 anglers surveyed, and of them, it was over 90% say that they regularly eat fish. Now, I think I know you've recently gotten to fly fishing, and so maybe our fly anglers aren't out there keeping and eating a bunch of their fish. But about 90% of anglers interviewed for this said that they're regularly eating fish from our waterways. So I'm encouraged by that, because it shows folks are participating with our resource. The issue about black bass, there are advisories for other fish here on our advisory list. And so whether if you're not eating largemouth bass, although you'd be surprised at the folks that do, there's other information out there for you. And then over time, it would be great to improve this program where we could have more testing to know what's going into our catfish or crappie, speckled trout, things like that. Again, we've got some of that data, but improving it's always good.
Yeah, I've that was something, is somebody who, did back in college, did a little bit of learning about how reports are made and digging into the data a little bit. Like I wanted to learn more. So you see a fish consumption advisory and you say, okay, well, there's a black bass advisory, do not eat. And you go, well, what about crappie? And there's no information anywhere on the report. So you're like, well, I think all of our listeners who tune in each week know that you talk to any guide on any body of water, and they'll tell you, like, what a bass eat? Shad. Well, what a crappie eat? Shad. So if they're living in the same waters and they have the same diet, it would seem to me that would at least warrant more testing than what I've heard that they currently do. My understanding is that as it stands, a lot of times crappie just don't get tested. I think the rationale is that they're a slower growing species with a slower metabolism. But it makes me wonder, like, if there's a do not eat advisory for black bass, how many crappie can I eat? Can I eat one serving, two servings, five servings? That's information that as it stands now, we don't know. Is there any changes in the Shore Act that would kind of impact how they did testing, or is it just limited to publishing the testing results?
So the meat of this bill is about public notification, public education. So it's not going to address the testing itself, although it leaves the ability to, with a task force that's assigned for oversight. But, you know, I want to remind listeners, I'm sure everybody knows this, but it's often good to be reminded that, you know, our government, that they don't work for somebody else, they work for you. And so if you decide that you want crappie tested more often, then that's something that they ought to do. So that, again, this creates an opportunity where now it's law and there's oversight, and we can have the ability to improve that program by the will of the people. Now, you're talking about why testing black bass instead of crappie, and I think it's a good opportunity to talk a little bit about how these contaminants get into these fish. And so, if you don't mind, I'll head down that road a little bit, because, you know, I'm sure everybody doesn't know how this works, and you know, if a bass is eating a shad and a crappie's eating a shad, shouldn't they have the same contaminants? And I've had to have some education recently to learn more about that myself. First of all, you know, pollutants get into our waterways through a number of different ways. We have, you know, when it rains, things run off from our roads, from things that are on the ground. We got agricultural practices run off from that. And there's other various sources of pollution. But also, we permit the ability for people to have an outfall that goes into a waterway. And so that permit allows you to put a certain amount of contaminants into the water. Sometimes folks go over that limit. That's a non-compliance, and there's a penalty to that. And sometimes folks stay under that limit. But either way, if it's legal or they're going over their limit, we are putting contaminants into our waterway. Now, that at its face, I'm sure sounds bad to a lot of folks. And you know, there's an argument to be made for that. However, well, there's not going to be an advisories for, at least down our way, shrimp and crabs or some of these smaller bait fish, minnows and things like that in our freshwater systems. And that's because of a process called biomagnification, which is a fancy way of saying the predatory fish have more pollutants in them because they're eating more fish. And so a black bass is more predatory than a crappie, although crappie is predatory for sure. So a black bass is going to have more contaminants than a crappie will. Now, again, we're speculating, so I don't have the data on a crappie in front of me to know what that difference should be. So the logic of they have a similar diet, therefore they have similar contaminants, that sounds sound to me. But I just want folks to know that it's these predatory fish that are the ones having the issue. And the ones that those smaller species usually don't have as many contaminants in.
For sure. And I would say anybody listening in, you know, the species that you see listed the most are going to be catfish. Again, like Will said, a highly, highly predatory fish. Black bass, you know, largemouth bass, but that could also be, you know, Alabama bass. That could be probably not so much your red eye bass. Matt's probably happy about that at least we don't have to worry about that. But striped bass,
y'all gonna be eating red eye bass anyway now.
I can't remember who I was talking to. It may have been Matt. I was poking fun of him, saying I was gonna keep one and eat him just for science. But and I guess that kind of carries over, like your insectivores, your, you know, bluegill, your panfish that aren't crappie. They don't seem to be impacted by that. So what is it exactly that's getting in the waterway that ends up in fish tissue and makes them test positive when they go to test for contaminants?
Yeah, there's a few contaminants that they do test for. I won't list all of them, but before I get started, I'll just say there's a long list of contaminants that could be in your fish. These are things that we aren't testing for, things that we know were in the water. And then there's also things that we don't know are in the water that we're certainly not tested for, because we don't even know that they're being put in there. I wanted to get started with that. But the three main things that we see here in our state that there are have advisories on, first is mercury. And nearly all fish and shellfish have some trace of mercury, no matter what body of water they come from. Reason for that, number one, is that it's now in our atmosphere. It's in our rainwater. So when you burn certain fossil fuels, coal, things like that, mercury gets in the atmosphere and it comes down and it gets in all of our water and very difficult to get out. So it's not necessarily coming from something that happens in Birmingham, it could be something happening halfway across the world. So that, you know, that's a human input, but it affects all of us here. But of course, we do our fair share of putting mercury into our waterways here in our state. And then there's just a naturally occurring mercury in the geology as well. Although that's a smaller percentage of what we see, I do think it's fair that people know that mercury exists in our geology. It comes into our waterways through natural processes. The second is PCBs. And I'm not going to tell you the whole name of PCBs. You can look it up if you want. But they cause a lot of health impacts over long exposures. They can be acutely toxic if you have them in high levels. Health impacts from PCBs, it's a probable carcinogen, hormone disruptor, can impact the immune system, thyroid. They can cause impacts to fertility and child development. And I didn't list those for mercury, but it's not entirely different from mercury. With mercury, you're dealing more with the unborn or a young child's developing nervous system. The third thing that we see in our advisories is arsenic. And I mentioned the coal ash pond earlier. Again, that's just one source. I'm not trying to pin it all on one source, but arsenic does come from coal and other things like that. And again, it's a heavy metal it causes risk for developing children, fetuses, those who are pregnant. You mentioned your wife, nursing, may want to have children in the future. So those, as usual, those that are most at risk are the ones that should pay the most attention to these advisories.
For sure. And I think kind of looping back into what we were saying earlier, like learning that and being more educated in it, like you learn a lot about, I learned a lot about fetus development that I did not know or care to know before my wife was pregnant. You just kind of pick up on it, whether you want to or not, going and doing your doctor checkups. But, you know, we looked at that information and I had a freezer full of catfish and she hasn't touched the stuff since. She just decided that in her mind, the risk was not worth it. And she hasn't eaten locally caught catfish since. I kept, I think, about 2 bags for my personal use. And then the rest we kind of gave to people, just told them, hey, look, like it's fresh, wild river caught catfish, but we're kind of cleaning out the freezer. Like this is why. Do you want it? Some people were like, yeah, not really. And other people were like, oh yeah, sure. Been eating it for years and not going to turn it down, you know? So I think I would definitely encourage
people.
You
give me a call next
it.
Time you're doing a freezer clean out now. All right. Don't get me when you're passing out fillets.
Oh man. We had, I tell you what, now we had to get rid of all the wild game to make room of all, for everything that comes with a baby, like all my hunting gear. Like that's really what you wanted to get in on was not so much the wild game. What you wanted to get in on was when I was giving away decoys and old hunting jackets
that's
and all
right.
That, trying to make room for the baby strollers that were going in my closet. that's definitely an info dump. And I know that may be kind of, you know, for some of our readers, more dense listening to fish consumption advisories and talking about 38-page PDFs and talking about legislative acts and stuff like that. That's not exactly as riveting as listening to people who are going out there and catching big bass. But I think it's important as we go into the new year. You know, last week we talked a lot about what you can do to kind of get ready for the season, organizing your tackle, working on your boats, wiring, you know, kind of getting ready. And I would encourage people, take a second and familiarize yourself with the information that Will kind of gave an overview of. It's interesting. It impacts you. It's something where you can, you know, spend an hour or two reading up on it. And then that's information that you've got for every fishing season to come. I am glad that I took the time. I'm glad Will pointed it out that day when we were hunting. I'm glad that I did the research on it. And just kind of in closing, Will, if people want to learn more, tell us again where they can go to kind of do that research for themselves.
Yeah, well, as always, you can visit Baykeeper's website, mobilebaykeeper.org, for this information and lots more. But again, if you want to follow or even help out for this particular piece of legislation, it's alshoreact.com. So alshoreact.com.
There we go. Guys, y'all go check that out. William, just want to take a second. Thank you for all that y'all do. And at some point we'll have to go now. I haven't been out that way on Dog River in a little bit, but at some point we need to make a play date and we'll go fish that little stretch of Rabbit Creek, see if we can't get on some chain pickerel back in there or something.
Yeah, it's clear enough. And you know, I appreciate you having me on to talk about this and other water quality issues. Now, if you want to have me on to tell folks how to not catch fish, that'll save them some time. I tell them what I do, and then they'll go, I'll make sure to not do that so I can go out there and catch some fish. So talk, if you want to talk fishing, we can do that too.
Well, there we go. Will, I appreciate you being on the show, and give Lily a biscuit for me tonight, and tell her that I don't have any hard feelings. We'll get her out there next year, and we'll get her on some more birds, see if we can awaken that killer instinct in her.
That's right. Well, you know, next season starts tomorrow, so we're gonna get her going.
There we go. That's it. That's a good attitude. Will, I appreciate you being on the show. Y'all take care.
Thanks for having me.
And we're going to take a quick break. Y'all take a minute to check out some of the businesses that keep this show free for you. This week's episode has been brought to you by. All right, guys, we are sitting down today with David Butler. He is the staff attorney and riverkeeper over at Cahaba River Keepers, and it's worked out pretty well. I'd originally envisioned that we would have three or four riverkeepers on for one episode, but last week we talked with Cade Kishler at Mobile River Keeper, and we talked with Justin Overton over at Coosa River Keeper, and that ended up being a pretty full show. And this week it just so happened that I ended up talking with Stephen Rockarts, who's a fly fishing guide over on the Cahaba River. We spoke with the owner of Calico Rod Company, who also does a lot of fly fishing over there on the Cahaba River. And now we're talking with one of the guys who probably knows more about the state of the Cahaba River than anybody else. So, David, welcome to the show. I appreciate you donating some of your time to us today.
Oh, my pleasure. I really appreciate the opportunity and always happy to talk about the Cahaba River.
Awesome. Well, kind of give us the scoop, kind of what's your personal biography? How did you end up where you are today? What's kind of your personal and professional background?
Yeah, so you know, I tell people all the time, I would have never in a million years imagined that this was what I would do. Like a lot of kids in the South, I grew up a Boy Scout. You know, I spent a lot of time on rivers in Kentucky, here in Alabama, camping, canoeing, fishing. But honestly, I never really understood my role in impacting and protecting those places. I just kind of was a recreational user. I didn't really feel an obligation to do much to take care of it. And you know, I guess I probably thought that there was a lot of state and federal agencies that did all that work, and there wasn't a whole lot to worry about. You know, fast forward, I was a finance major. I moved up to New York, lived there for 6 or 7 years, and I really just missed the South. Super crowded up there, just a whole different way of life. And so I came back to Alabama. I went to journalism school. I wanted to become like an investigative reporter and tell stories of people who didn't have a voice. And while I was in school, I started renting canoes and taking people out on trips on the Cahaba. And you know, I would really love introducing somebody to the river for the first time, and then they would come back and they'd have all kinds of questions, like, what kind of fish was this? I saw this bird. And so, you know, selfishly, I was like, I'm going to learn more about the Cahaba River just to become a better guide and you know, get more tips, right? Like, people will you know, kind of come away with more information and knowledge, and maybe share that with people and help generate more leads for me to get more people out on the river. And so I started searching around. I had never heard of river keepers, really. I think I'd heard a little bit about the Black Warrior River Keeper, but I found my boss, Dr. Myra Crawford, who had started Cahaba River Keeper after she retired from UAB. And she was really committed to collecting information. So we'd heard a lot of, you know, kind of anecdotal evidence that the river was suffering, but we didn't really know what that looked like. And so I came and started doing volunteer work. They offered me a position on the board, and then the board asked me to become the first full-time riverkeeper, and that's how I got here. In the middle of all that, I went to law school. You know, unfortunately, asking nicely doesn't always get the job done, and so instead of hiring lawyers to do everything for us, we thought it'd be a great idea if we had in-house legal help, and so that's kind of how I ended up where I am.
That's an awesome story. Yeah, it sounds like you've got a lot of good skills and kind of wear a lot of hats, and that's a really cool that's a really cool qualifications to end up in that position, you know. So that's really interesting to hear. Would your canoe float trips? So you primarily, you know, a recreational user in the sense that you did a lot of backpacking, a lot of canoeing, Are you a big fisherman yourself? I know you've got fly fishermen involved with Cobb or River Keeper. Is that something that you partake in?
Yeah, I'm a big fisherman. I wish I got to fish more. I mean, some people like Steven Rockerts, they got it made, man. That's because they just fish all the time. I don't even know if that guy has a job, but I love to fish. And it's just something really unique to me about throwing something in the water and not really knowing what's gonna, what you're gonna pull out. I love basically every fish, and so I'm not really a target fisherman. I mean, I'm happy to catch any kind of fish. I certainly have been, kind of targeting red-eye bass, I guess, more lately, but I love to catch gar. I love to catch sunfish, really anything. And so I didn't grow up in a family where my dad was an outdoorsman. He was a car guy, liked to work on old cars, muscle cars, that kind of thing. And so I always kind of got my exposure to the outdoors through Boy Scouts or friends and family. My uncle up in New Jersey was a huge outdoorsman and was kind of a mentor for me growing up. But like I said, I never really knew or appreciated what I do in my daily life, how that impacts my ability to do those kind of recreational things that you mentioned. And so, I started, really just doing canoe trips is just something to do in my spare time. And I really, really kind of reconnected with my love of being on the water.
Awesome. Well, tell me a little bit about the Cahaba River, because I know we got folks all over the state, and some of our listeners, they're going to be familiar with the area. I have a feeling that most of them won't, because I know my knowledge in general of the Cahaba, I know probably the least about the Cahaba. I feel like, just for whatever reason, that one's not quite a sleeper. Like, people know what it is, but like, you don't see it as much, on fishing reports and stuff like that. I don't know if it's because it doesn't have a lot of big lakes. Maybe it's a little harder to get a power boat up it in a lot of spots, and that kind of keeps people off of it. I know the south end, I know there's some public land around it that I've hunted in the past, and I know people talk about fishing it where it ties into the Alabama, but kind of give me just broad strokes, where it runs through, what it's close to as far as a reference point on the map, so people can have that in their head. And what type of river system are we looking at with the Cahaba?
Yeah, so it's about, a little bit over 190 miles long. Starts up north of Trustful, a really unique place. Kind of the headwaters of the Cahaba is sort of in a little triangle with the Black Warrior to the west and the Coosa to the east. And there's a spot there where you can stand, basically in all three watersheds. And so we're the little river in the middle between them. And there's good and bad for the, from that. We escaped a lot of the damming craze that happened on other rivers. And so most of the river is not accessible by a power boat. I mean, the lower part of the river, you get some water that backs up from the Alabama River. But for the most part, you got to work to do much on the Cahaba, whether it's hike, canoe, really moved a long way forward and having more public access. But the Cahaba is not a place that you can go and hop in a canoe and do, a 1 hour, quick fishing trip. I mean, you really have to be kind of committed to get in a boat. I mean, most of the trips that you could do, are going to be more than 3 hours long, require shuttling back and forth, and it's just a little, it's different, and it requires a little bit more work. I joke with the Black Warrior and Coosa River Keepers that, they have a series of bathtubs, not a river. And our river is still a more natural system. There's a lot of, kind of confusion. When I started here, people used to tell me it was the longest free-flowing river in the state. But I knew that there was a big dam at Highway 280, which the Birmingham Waterworks Board uses to hold back water so they can withdraw it from the river for our drinking water. Serves about, 500,000 to 600,000 people in the Birmingham area. And so we do have some dams on the river. We have a large dam at 280 and a couple smaller dams. And then you go down, as you go through Birmingham, Homewood, Mountain Brook, Vestavia, Hoover, out into Helena. And then kind of the crown jewel of the Cahaba River is the Cahaba River National Wildlife Refuge in Bibb County, West Blocton. A lot of people know about it just from the Cahaba lily that blooms there, and it attracts people from all over the world, really, to come see those flowers for a month every year when they're blooming. Then it kind of leaves West Blocton, Bibb County, goes down into Perry County and Dallas County through the Black Belt. And the river changes a great deal. So as you're, you know, up around Birmingham, you have some kind of high rock bluffs and so forth. And then as you get, you know, drop off into the coastal plain around Centerville, the whole river changes. And so the banks kind of fall down, and they're, you know, not much rock at all. It's almost all soil. The river's bigger, wider. Up around Birmingham, you don't have consistent flow during the summer. It gets really dry and low. We're down, you know, once you get into the coastal plain, you can paddle that pretty much all year. But it's really rural there, right? So the, you know, up around Birmingham, we're, you know, super developed. And then as you go, you know, as you go south of Helena, you sort of start getting into the really rural part of our watershed before, you know, ultimately it empties into the Alabama River near Selma. And it's, you know, it's really, really unique in that sense that you can, you know, start at the top of the river and it looks nothing like the bottom of the river at all. And there's a lot of, you know, a lot of challenges with that. So certainly on the Black Warrior, the Coosa, you have people who are, you know, kind of more intimately connected to the water. You know, they may have a lake house and they're swimming, playing in the water all summer. Where on the Cahaba, you have people that live next to the river, but maybe don't spend time in it, you know, every day or all summer. And so it's something that is revered around the state, but people don't really know why. They, you know, they hear about it. They are aware to some degree about how unique the biodiversity is, but maybe not, you know, how important it is to the rest of the state. And I think, you know, something else that's really, you know, important for people to understand about the Cahaba is when we talk about it being unique, it's not unique because it's always been unique. It's unique because we've done so much damage to all the rivers in our state. So when you look to our east, the Coosa River, when that river was dammed, that, you know, they kind of say that's one of the largest mass extinction events in North American history. Certainly on the Black Warrior River, you know, you had a population of those lilies that was larger than anywhere in the world at a place called Squaw Shoals. And that shoal was flooded when they dammed that river. And so we've lost a lot already. And we're, you know, I feel particularly fortunate that my river system hasn't been impacted as much as some of the other river systems around the state.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's interesting. I want to read up on that more because you're the second person now who's mentioned that Coosa mass extinction event. And I kind of don't want to read about it, but you know, I've kind of, it's piqued my curiosity a little bit. Like you said, what are some of the challenges? Each waterway has its own unique challenges when it comes to protecting it. And it sounds like the big thing for the Cahaba is, one, it's a river that, you know, it doesn't have maybe the same, you know, public awareness that some of the other rivers have. Like everybody, you know, is familiar with Mobile Bay and kind of understands, you know, it's got a big tourism pool, you know, so do a lot of the bathtubs that you mentioned on the Coosa River system. You know, there's some economic benefit to places up and down through there. The Cahaba River doesn't seem like it has, you know, doesn't seem like it pulls big tourist money. It seems like in a large way, it's kind of out of sight, out of mind. Does that lead to anything that kind of impacts y'all's day-to-day activities, make y'all's work week look a little different maybe than, you know, your counterparts that you talked to over at Coosa River Keeper, Mobile Bay Keeper, and Black Warrior?
Yeah, I think our watershed is uniquely challenging. You know, I would say that one of the things that I'm a little bit jealous about is that on some of the bigger river systems, you can go to a boat ramp, put in a motorboat, and kind of go where you want to go. Where on the Cahaba, you know, anything we do on the river is in a canoe or a kayak or by foot. And so it's more difficult to access, you know, certainly. Like, so if I want to go look at a area of concern, I've got to put a boat in the water. I've got to, you know, commit to 3, 4, 5 hour paddle, which isn't always easy. You know, I mean, we stay really busy. You know, I think you look around at the work that the riverkeepers do in the state. There's 10 of us around the state. And, you know, I'm incredibly proud of how far we stretch the money that we have. But that means that, you know, my watershed's 1,900 square miles. And so we have a staff of 5 people. It's almost impossible to cover our watershed. And so somebody calls me with the, you know, pollution concern. If I can't get to it by land, it means I got to put a boat in the water. And it means that that's a full day of work to go look at one thing. So that's really challenging to be able to kind of really, you know, look out and see what we need to take care of. But then it's also like an opportunity for us, right? So we do a swim guide program. Coosa River Keeper and Mobile Bay Keeper both do it. And that puts us out on the water. You know, we sample at 29 sites every week, every Thursday from May through September. And so every week I know that we are going to put our eyes on the river in 29 different places. And from that, we've been able to, you know, kind of document some changes, identify problems, get them fixed. And we've built a huge, you know, library of data where, you know, we're collecting information all the time. And, when things do happen, we can look back and say, okay, well, we've been sampling on this particular creek for 10 years, and this is what's typical here, and this is what it looks like now. And so we have really been able to collect a lot of information about the river, which helps us kind of advocate for it. And I think the other, you know, the other factor is kind of what I was saying to you, is that people have a very casual relationship with the Cahaba. They love the idea of it. They drive over it. They see it in their backyard. But their feet aren't in the water in the same way that you are at a lake. And so there's just a different connection. And so when people fish the Cahaba, whether they're fly fishermen or traditional rod and reel, I know that they are real, you know, that they are committed fishermen, because you have to really work for it.
Yeah, it sounds like an interesting place, and I need to get up there. I've had Steven on the show several times, and I need to let him float me down the river and cook me a burger and go see it, right? Because it sounds like an awesome place. What all those challenges that you mentioned, if there's people who are listening to this show and they're local to that area, right, that's their waterway, and they want to do something to help preserve it, I guess, what are y'all's most pressing needs right now? What's coming up on y'all's calendar that y'all could use help with? And if people want to help, how do they go about getting in contact with you?
Yeah. So, you know, one of the largest things that we need help is to understand that there's a balance between everything that we do. So we get this reputation of being opposed to growth and development. And what we need people to understand is that, you know, these problems that we're talking about are not things that we think are going to happen. They're not things that, it's not my opinion. I mean, it is a fact, right? Like the way we have developed has had a serious impact on the river. And we need people to understand that, because ultimately, you know, whatever the issue is, we're most effective when the community supports what we're doing. And so, you know, a lot of times we'll get people who believe that, you know, these are nitpicky issues and they don't affect them, and they don't really care about a snail or a mussel, but it's much more complex than that, right? So our largest problem on the Cahaba is stormwater development, all the pollution that stormwater brings to the river. And, you know, it certainly has a negative impact on the river, but it also has an impact on your neighbors. You know, I can't tell you how many people we meet whose houses are flooded, property damaged because of poor stormwater management. And so we allow in this state, we allow cities to subsidize development by absorbing the cost of maintaining stormwater infrastructure. And in a lot of ways, it's kind of typical of a lot of different issues in this state. So you see a lot of problems with sewage treatment infrastructure. And, you know, just like I'm saying about needing the community to be educated, a lot of people believe that when you flush your toilet, that's the end of the story, right? But when you flush your toilet, whatever leaves your house has to go through a series of pipes. It's got to go to a facility where it can be treated. It's got to be treated, you know, appropriately and completely, and then it's discharged back to the river. And so, you know, while we don't feel the impact of you know, sewage infrastructure failing in our house all the time, it's happening around us in the community all over the place, right? So I was down yesterday on Hurricane Creek in the Black Warrior watershed, investigating a sewage overflow with the Hurricane Creek Keeper. And where the sewage overflow was a really popular beach in his watershed. There was, you know, 100 people out playing in the water over the weekend who were completely unaware that they were swimming in, you know, body of water that had been contaminated by raw sewage. And so we need people to desire more information, to learn, to be educated. And not to say that we're right all the time, but I do have a lot of experience in seeing the impact of these issues that we're talking about. So when I talk about stormwater, like I said, it's not my opinion. I mean, I personally observe it on a daily basis. And so we need people to really care enough to invest some time in learning. And then, of course, you know, we have the same problems that you do in a lot of watersheds. We've got trash, litter problems all over the place. which, you know, we all pay for. I always get a kick out of people saying, well, they pay people to pick it up. Well, the they in that sentence is us, right?
Right.
So every dollar that the state or our city or whoever pays to pick up trash, that's taken away from something else, right? And so we do a lot of cleanup, education, awareness events, things like that. And then, you know, we really try to help communities find a balance between what they want for their community and what is healthy for the river.
Well, David, I appreciate you sitting down with me today. Guys, if you're local to the Cahaba River, if I know sometimes you guys may feel a little bit left out. We talk more about the Coosa and the Tennessee and the Mobile Tensaw Delta waterways, but we're going to try to sneak the Cahaba in there a little bit more often because it sounds like an awesome opportunity. David, again, thank you, guys. Y'all go support David, support the Cahaba Riverkeeper, support your local riverkeeper. It's really important work, and I think it's important that we realize that, you know, Alabama has some really amazing waterways, and we've been blessed in some ways that's let us keep what we have, but there are concerns. There's things we've not done great in the past. There's some things that we're moving forward with that maybe ain't the best idea. So it's important to just kind of stay abreast of the situation and, you know, kind of keep up with it and make sure that you're making a positive impact. You know, sportsmen have a long history of doing that. Everybody's familiar, I think, at this point with Pittman-Robertson Act and the Dingell-Johnson Act and the different efforts that sportsmen have made over the years. But I think it's important moving into the future that we kind of keep that up. We don't drop the ball as we go. So check out the Riverkeepers. And David, I'll let you get back to it.
Awesome. I appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. All right, guys, that was David Butler with the Cahaba Riverkeepers. Again, be sure to check them out. Support your local riverkeepers. They do a really good job kind of supporting the fishery. Like David said, it's easy to assume, oh, somebody else is handling that. You know, the state handles it, whatever. The state, everybody now has a lot on their hands, and these little nonprofits that do a lot of this work for us, they really need our help. They're doing a public service. And if you fish, if you like to eat fish and you like to swim in the water and you just like the river to be clean and clear, makes sense to support the riverkeeper. So check them out. And we're going to take a quick break. Y'all take a minute to check out some of the businesses that keep this show free for you. This week's episode has been brought to you by Visit Mississippi. If you're looking for a beautiful state that's packed with outdoor attractions, check out Mississippi. Of course, you know about the Mississippi River, but there are lots of great rivers for paddling throughout the state. Coastal Mississippi's waters are perfect for deep sea fishing or exploring the state's 5 uninhabited barrier islands. You'll find national forests with campgrounds, trails and recreational sites, 25 parks, and wildlife management areas too. Whatever you like to do in the great outdoors, you can do in Mississippi, where wanderers are welcome. Plan your adventure at visitmississippi.org/outdoors. All right, folks, that's going to wrap it up for this week. Please subscribe, rate, and review wherever you listen to podcasts. And again, don't forget to text that code ALFFR to 779-345-2918. Again, just text ALFFR, that's Alabama Freshwater Fishing Report, to 779-345-2918. Subscribe to our email list, and we'll send you the promo code via email. This week's episode of the Alabama Freshwater Fishing Report has been brought to you by L&M Marine. Has something for everyone, from small hunting boats to pontoons to bigger bay and hybrid boats for the hardcore angler. You can visit them at 34600 Highway 59 in Stapleton, Alabama, or give them a call at 251-937-1380. Also brought to you by Southeastern Pond Management. Since 1989, Southeastern Pond Management has been a leader in pond and lake management services. Schedule an obligation-free consultation today. Call 1-888-830-POND or info@sepond.com. Also brought to you by Killer Dock. Combines durability, function, and design to uniquely upgrade your entire dock experience. Visit killerdock.com to see more. Also brought to you by Fish Bites. Whether you're hitting the sand with set rig or fishing the flats and marshes for speckled trout, redfish, and flounder, Fish Bites has something for you. Check out the full line of scented saltwater and freshwater baits at fishbites.com.